This is The Guardian.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yota Motulenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to really see something that's sad, take a look at what happened.
There's no place in America for this kind of violence. It's sick. It's sick.
Spain, champions of Europe yet again.
Tonight we fell short. We didn't keep the ball well enough.
And it's firmly my intention that this government will be different, will be far more Gareth Southgate, far less Michael Gove. The era of division needs to end.
I'm Pippa Carrera.
And I'm Kieran Stacey.
You're listening to Politics Weekly Westminster for The Guardian. So I'm sitting here at my desk in Westminster, Kieran, and I've got a copy of today's Guardian in front of me with this astonishing photo of Donald Trump having just been shot at his campaign rally over the weekend, surrounded by Secret Service agents who are trying to get him off the stage, and fist in the air with the backdrop of the blue sky and the American flag. I mean, this picture is going to be absolutely iconic, and it was taken and distributed, you know, worldwide within minutes of the attack taking place. I was actually lying in bed because it was about midnight our Saturday night, and got a message from my brother in Australia, who obviously different time zone, was up and consuming news, whereas I was supposed to be going to sleep. Got a text message saying, "Have you seen Trump's being shot?" And then inevitably, you know, straight on my phone, straight on the telly to see what had happened. Yeah. Where were you when the news hit?
Well, I was fast asleep. I had gone to bed earlier. So the first I knew about it was when I woke up on Sunday morning. And the first thing I saw was a note from Downing Street saying the Prime Minister has issued his, I think it was something along the lines of condolences or best wishes to the Trump family after this terrible act of violence. I thought, what on earth is that about? And then, first thing you do, you fire up your news app and then you kind of realize. I think one of the interesting things about that photo is that was the first thing I really saw then on Sunday morning. So you instantly knew, okay, he's not dead. He's not seriously injured. And what a moment that is going to prove to be, because that image will become the defining image of this US election, I suspect.
Yeah, and it absolutely kind of feels that it's switched this thing on its head. I was in the States last week. We last spoke when I was in Washington. And all the talk amongst Washington politicos and journalists was that the Democrats were going to give Joe Biden the NATO summit, and then we're going to step up their efforts to try and encourage him to stand down. They're concerned about his mental acuity, his age going into this election, and they would rather a younger, more vital candidate to stand against Donald Trump. And that was kind of flying back from the States at the weekend. That was kind of where we thought things would be. And actually, all the focus now is on Trump as he goes into the Republican convention in Milwaukee. And it feels like it has absolutely kind of solidified his base. And whether it means that the switchers, I think we'll have to wait and see. But we already know that Trump is gaining votes and Biden is losing them. And you can just imagine Democrats not switching to Trump as a result of this, or swing voters switching to Trump as a result of this, but not voting at all, which, of course, in US politics means that it looks more likely that Trump could end up, assuming he's going to be endorsed this week by the Republicans and officially become their candidate, is almost certain to be back in the White House.
Look, I think there are a couple of things to say about that. First of all, let's not presume that this now hands Trump the presidency. I've seen a lot of coverage over the last couple of days that points out that Ronald Reagan enjoyed a big poll surge after he was shot. And I think for about 3 months, he saw a poll boost of several percentage points. But then that faded very quickly. And I think voters are quite savvy, really, probably more savvy than we give them credit for. They know that external events happen. They know that shocks happen. And they don't necessarily let it influence their views of the outcome. Now, let me point you to a more recent example here in this country, a much worse example given what actually happened. But Joe Cox, of course, was killed right in the final days of the EU referendum campaign. And people thought, well, maybe this will have an effect. Maybe this will kind of increase some kind of sympathy vote for Remain. Of course, it didn't. Most people could see that this is a terrible thing, but actually didn't necessarily influence how they were going to vote on the day. The only thing I think for Trump is it makes it more difficult, first of all, for Democrats to attack him, because you start to look like you're being in some way unpatriotic if you do so. And also, if he plays it right, he can start to pivot away from being this very divisive character to more of a unifying one. So, look, you know, I survived this assassination attempt and now I'm going to try and bring this divided country together. That, we're told, is what he's going to say at his convention speech. He apparently has rewritten that speech.
And he already has started saying it. We heard that in his initial reactions. Yeah. I actually was quite surprised, because this is the man that, of course, has used violent, degrading and even apocalyptic language with his followers. You know, he's warned of a bloodbath if he's not elected. He's talked about immigrants in the US illegally poisoning the blood of our country. And then, of course, he was president and encouraged people to head to the Capitol for the January 6th Capitol riots. So I think it will take quite a lot for him to rewrite history. But I was very struck with him and his wife, Melania, coming out and talking about this being a moment to unify the country. I think you're right that it makes it harder for the Democrats to attack him. But it's not just Trump, of course. It's all his supporters. And already we're seeing them point the finger at the Democrats, at the Liberals, and somehow suggest that they're behind this. I mean, this individual was clearly very disturbed. I think he was bullied at school. But he was a card-carrying Republican. J.D. Vance, for example, the Ohio senator who's one of those who's tipped to be Trump's running mate, suggesting that it's not just some isolated incident. The central premise of the Biden campaign, he said, is that Donald Trump is an authoritarian fascist who must be stopped at all costs. That rhetoric led directly to Trump's attempted assassination. Look, America is already really divided. I mean, much more so than here. And with some of the sort of the populist rhetoric we've heard in recent years. And I'm not sure that Trump will be able to pull it back and sort of recast himself as the great unifier, even if that's what he wants to try and do.
Yeah, look, I mean, all I'd say about that is that, yes, for now, as you're pointing out, Trump and Melania are kind of making these unifying, almost centrist noises. But I think where you find the real soul of the modern day Republican Party is more in what J.D. Vance has been saying. And they just can't help themselves, and Trump will not be able to help himself. I've seen this before from Trump, where he kind of pivots to centrism. I remember he gave a reasonably well-received State of the Union speech one year where everybody said, oh, look, see, he can do unifying. But eventually, it doesn't take long. He goes off script. He starts kind of going down his rabbit holes. He will be encouraged, I would say, by his followers to follow conspiracy theories. And I'm just not sure that necessarily plays well with the kind of voter that he needs to win this election. Those kind of suburban Republicans who deserted him back in 2020.
And of course, he showed his instinct was actually quite combative. I mean, his very first response was to stand up, put his fist in the air and shout the words, fight, fight, fight. Now, there's not much unifying about that. Yeah. But of course, we worry here. I mean, you've already mentioned Joe Cox. Obviously, David Amos is another MP who sadly had their life taken as a result of their being in a prominent position of being an MP. And we saw it over the general election campaign as well, didn't we, with MPs including Labour's Rishanara Ali, Jess Phillips, Shabana Mahmood, all suffering threats and intimidation in the run-up to the election. And those particular women were candidates standing in seats with a strong opposition to Labour's stance in the war on Gaza. But we've had the UK government's advisor on political violence, John Woodcock, writing to the Home Secretary, Yvette Cooper, today about election violence, saying that the Trump shooting highlights that danger, that he is concerned that the series of incidents in the election campaign could have been a concerted campaign by extremists that underlied the gravity of the threat to our democracy here. Now, it does feel, not least because we're not a gun culture in the way that they are in the States, but we have lost two MPs in recent years. It does still feel that we are some way away from the sort of division and the political violence that we've seen in the States. But we've had the Speaker of the House of Commons speaking over the weekend, saying it's the thing that worries him most, is political violence, that he has sleepless nights over it, and that threats and abuse against MPs are amongst the worst he's seen. What can Keir Starmer do about that?
Difficult to know. I mean, first of all, Starmer has to, I think, try and reach out to that group of voters who are feeling particularly angry and disaffected at the moment, who you probably voted Labour once upon a time and now feel like the party has deserted them. But, you know, that is never going to be enough to placate the most angry of, you know, of people who feel like they want to target MPs. Now, I was talking to MPs throughout the campaign about a lot of the violent rhetoric a lot of the time and the intimidation that they were seeing. One of the things I noticed is they never wanted to speak about it openly. Mm. Getting them to actually talk about what they were going through was almost impossible. And I did do one story that kind of tried to explain what was happening, but mostly these MPs did not want to talk. I think we need more openness about what's going on, what the level of threats is. And I think that once tackled, we also need to really look hard at who their relatively credible supporters are. So there are candidates around the country who I think have stood as pro-Gaza candidates who have fanned a lot of quite violent, at times misogynistic rhetoric. And that needs to be looked at very carefully.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think Starmer needs to try and get a hearing, really, with some of those voters that are so disillusioned with British politics, many of whom, of course, flock to reform almost as a protest vote. And Nigel Farage, their leader, of course, being one of those who has been on the receiving end of some of that political violence, much lesser than some of the other MPs. But, you know, he had a milkshake lobbed over him. And I don't think anybody thinks there's any excuse for that in a democracy where actually we should be debating rather than resorting to such behaviour. He, of course, is off to Milwaukee himself this week. He's a great friend of Donald Trump. I mean, that's going to be a fascinating one to watch. He's often accused of taking quite a sort of similar populist approach to his politics. We haven't really seen him let loose on the green benches yet of Westminster. So let's see how that goes. But Kieran, I'm about to head over to Downing Street for the first Downing Street briefing of the week. And I suspect that one of the questions that's going to come up is about the England team, what the Prime Minister's thoughts were about the Euros final against Spain last night in Berlin. He, of course, was there. And whether Gareth Southgate, the England manager, should be in line for some sort of honour as a result of, you know, all of his hard work. Where were you watching the football match and how are you feeling about it this morning?
To be honest, I was at home and I'm not feeling as sore as I was this time 3 years ago, because I think in that game against Italy, especially in that first half when England were the better side, you felt like this was our moment. This time we were just played off the park by Spain. It would have been a travesty, really, had England scraped through. I did feel when the equaliser went in, maybe, you know, that the Spanish team might panic just a little bit and back off some of England's faster strikers, but that didn't happen and they quickly regained control of the match. So I actually feel better this morning than I thought I would. And also, I would say, please don't knight Gareth Southgate yet unless he quits, because let's save it up. If he stays as England manager, we need something to give him when he wins the World Cup in 2 years' time.
So we've got the World Cup in 2 years' time. And somebody was saying on the radio this morning that, you know, 60 years of hurt actually scans better for when it comes to the song than 58 years or whatever it is we're at now. It's a nice round number. And I was also told off by my husband, my English husband, I should say, for reminding him, and I'll probably get into terrible trouble for saying this here, that, of course, the one team to beat Spain in the Euro qualifiers was, of course, Scotland, my team. But I better not repeat that because I'll be in terrible trouble.
That means Scotland's European champions.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. That's the logic. I should say I'm not one of these Scots that is anybody but England. I live in England. I've got an English husband and I was definitely supporting England last night. I was disappointed as the next person to see them beaten to Spain. But that wouldn't stop me, I'm afraid, asking questions about it at the briefing later.
Do you know what's funny with just bringing it to politics is that whenever you hear Keir Starmer, because Keir Starmer is obviously a football obsessive, but whenever you hear him talk about football, somehow that love doesn't quite come across. Somebody described it on Twitter as, it's astonishing that Keir Starmer, for somebody who's completely obsessed by football, whenever he's asked to talk about it in public, talked about it like he's just looked it up on Wikipedia. So for some reason, whether it's because he's trying not to let his complete obsession shine,
yeah,
or whatever it is, he never quite sounds, very natural when he's talking about football.
And of course, Lisa Nandy, the culture secretary, the sports secretary, was there as well and was doing the media round this morning saying that she hadn't had any sleep. So I'm not quite sure whether she was up all night commiserating or whether she was up all night travelling or what was going on there.
Just making
her way
around
the fan park. As far as London, yeah. But obviously a devoted fan. There's more travel for ministers today. We've got Nick Thomas-Simmons, the EU relations minister, heading to Brussels for his first face-to-face meeting with the European Commission's post-Brexit coordinator, Maros Sefcovic. And actually, it was really interesting because even though the summit last week was NATO, we had the defence secretary, we had the prime minister, we had the foreign secretary, we also had the EU relations minister there. And Nick Thomas-Simmons came along on the trip, apparently to use the opportunity to meet some of the many European leaders in the margins of the summit that were there. He's obviously in Brussels trying to find the reset button in UK-EU relationship during those talks with the Commission's executive vice president. They're going to be quite informal talks. There's nothing sort of, there's not sort of meaty substance on the agenda just yet. It does feel like it's starting to rebuild relations. But Britain's hosting the next European political community meeting. This is this collection of, I think, 40 European countries, so it's beyond the EU, set up by Emmanuel Macron. This is the fourth meeting of them at Blenheim Palace on Thursday. And you're going to be there, Kieran, aren't you? So tell us why it's significant.
No, I'm looking forward to it. It's only a one-day summit, so it's not very long. But this is, of course, Keir Starmer's first chance to get around other European heads of government. And start to lay the groundwork from what you're talking about, which we're not really supposed to call it a renegotiation, but essentially it is supposed to be a renegotiation of our relationship with Europe. If you want my tip for who to look out for in terms of who might be the most consequential, one of the most consequential ministers of this government, I think it would be Nick Thomas-Simmons. He's got a very wide-ranging brief to go and start negotiations. Now, in the first place, they'll just be about things like veterinary products, agriculture, defence and security, try and get some of those agreements off the ground. But the feeling is it might turn into a slightly broader renegotiation. And I think that's the kind of thing that he will be laying the groundwork for this week.
And the big question for him back home will be if you get a better deal on things like veterinary issues. Defence and security is obviously a bit different because Britain's such a big military player that actually it's for the benefit of the EU to share security information and so on. But for all the extras, if you like, that Britain might want, what do you give in return? And there's the big question there, of course, about whether migration becomes part of that.
Yeah, well, the other thing on the agenda is going to be migration. And from what I understand, migration is going to be talked about as one of two or three issues during the big plenary session. That's what the Brits have, requested. In the past, the other European heads of government have got very annoyed at the Brits for trying to make this all about migration, whereas it's not necessarily supposed to be that forum. But this time around, I think the fact that the UK is hosting it means that Britain can actually start to make some demands of the other countries in terms of what they talk about. And also, what with the rise of the far right across much of Europe, I think, it's on the agenda anyway. So I would expect a lot of the discussion to focus around security and migration. Now, the big question that Keir Starmer has to answer at some point on migration is, okay, if you want a new returns agreement, what are you going to give in return, as you say, Pippa? And it almost certainly has to be to sign up to some kind of quota of number of people that you're willing to accept as part of an agreement to send other people back to mainland Europe. Obviously, they didn't want to say that during the election campaign. Is he going to start talking about it this week? Maybe it's too early, but that is essentially the deal on the table. And Starmer has to decide whether he's ready to take it or not.
And the fact that the summit is at Blenheim, which of course is the birthplace of Winston Churchill, gives him an opportunity to, given everything we've been talking about with the States, to offer a vision of Europe distinct from authoritarianism. He, I think, will expect to see him to draw connections between Churchill's post-war support for the ECHR, the European Court of Human Rights, and the feeling, and obviously Starmer's a former human rights lawyer himself, that the court enforces, what it represents is the best of Europe, which is very different sort of tone from what we've seen with the previous government. Ultimately, though, it's going to be about repairing relationships. And it feels like that this is a good opportunity for that to start. The other big event this week, and this is domestic political event, is the King's Speech, the Labour government's first King's Speech. Now, it's a long time since we've had one of these. Now, what the King's Speech is the formal beginning of the new parliament, and the king reads out a speech which is written by the government, setting out all the legislation that the government hopes to bring in over the course of what is normally the following year. And historically, it's about having a vote to test whether the government commands a majority in the House of Commons. Of course, with a majority of 172, it shouldn't be too difficult for the government to get this through. And we got all the pomp and ceremony of the monarch arriving from Buckingham Palace in a gold coach and then donning the robe of state and the crown and processing to the throne, the gold throne in the House of Lords, Black Rod banging on the door of the House of Commons three times to get all the MPs through. And of course, my favourite bit is that one MP is held hostage in Buckingham Palace to ensure the monarch's safe return. But of course, it's not just about the pomp and ceremony, is it? It's about the substance and what that says about the legislative year ahead.
Yeah, we're going to get, I think, more than 35 bills. So this is quite a dense King's speech. The thing that I remember from previous King's speeches is you get very excited at the list of bills when they come, but actually the details we get on each one are relatively scarce. So we kind of know what Labour's legislative agenda is. You know, we know that they want to do things like setting up Great British Energy, that they want to legislate for improved workers' rights. They want to repeal certain things that the previous government did and also do other things that the previous government left undone. One thing I'm watching out for quite carefully is whether Labour returns to the issue of both renters reform and leasehold reform, which was one of those Gove unfinished projects. But, you know, once you kind of got the title and the basic outline of the bill, you actually have to wait a little bit longer to find out, for example, on workers' rights, oh, exactly what do we mean when we say an enter into 0 hours contract?
And not least because with several of the planned bits of legislation, they're going to require consultation before anything actually happens. We asked Keir Starmer about the King's speech on our way back from the States the weekend. And he was very clear that his priority was, and the government's priority is going to be the economy. So I think we should expect to see things like the new bill to enforce tough spending rules where the Office for Budget Responsibility gets a strengthened role for any sort of tax and spend decision the government makes. It has to be has to go through their doors first. And I think anything that's sort of around the growth agenda, so, you know, you mentioned housing planning as well, obviously, of course, although more consultations ahead on those. So I think we expect to see them prioritising those things. What I'll be looking out for are the other bits, the bits that have been promised, like, you know, are we actually going to get votes at 16?
Yeah.
Is the House of Lords reform going to be more than just getting rid of hereditary peers, or are we going to see peers forced to retire at 80? You know, the stuff that they said they do, but isn't necessarily as much of a priority for the first term, but would nevertheless show probably quite quickly, much more quickly than some of the stuff that's following consultation, that they are willing and going to bring about the change that they promised.
Well, do you remember that Sue Gray, at some point before the election, apparently told shadow cabinet ministers she wanted to do as much as she could do without going down the legislative route, because legislation takes a long time and can get amended and, you know, is often prone to consultation and delays. So maybe there's a bunch of stuff they're going to try and do through the non-legislative route. But 35 plus bills suggest that Sue Gray wasn't very successful at pruning down the number of bills that they're going to try and pass.
And we'll be poring over all of that later this week. That's all from us for now. Please like and follow Politics Weekly UK to make sure you keep getting our episodes in your feed. We'll be back on Wednesday for a special episode covering the King's speech. This episode was produced by Eva Krisiak, music by Axel Cucoutier, and the executive producer is Maz Ebtahaj. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This is The Guardian.
Whether you know your kimchi from your kefir or it's your first time boiling an egg, you'll be able to make delicious meals easily with The Guardian's new Feast app. Discover vibrant vegan dishes with me, Mira Soda, hearty comfort foods with Nigel Slater, bold flavours with Yota Motulenghi, and many more tasty offerings from expert Guardian cooks. Experience the ultimate cooking app, Feast, today. Download now and enjoy a 14-day free trial. Terms and conditions apply.